Let me take you to page 13. We're in Roman numeral number 4, and now if there is a quick transition between what we have covered, plan, to the reality that nothing works. Nothing works well, nothing works easily, nothing will work naturally. You've heard me say that with regard to sexuality, but it's also true for the vast domain of our relationship. Things don't come easily relationally for any of us. What do we need to deal with? If you need a simple category to understand what Roman numeral number 4 is about, it really is this. Till you take into account sin, your marriage cannot grow well. Until you face the nature of sin in your life, in her life, in your marriage, then redemption means less. It is an obvious sentence that comes out of the reflection of Luke 7, verse 47. He who is forgiven little loves little. And the parallel, obviously, is true. He who is forgiven much loves much. And so it isn't a matter that I want my wife to know what a sinner she is. That's not the point. I want to be the one to love. And the only way for me to learn to love more, oddly as it may sound, paradoxical as it may sound, the only way for me to learn to love more is to understand how deeply and of what I have been forgiven of. So what I want to do, some of we've already covered, some we'll cover rather briefly, and you'll go, you got a whole page there, and you said two sentences. Whatever. Here's the point. We want to be as gods. What I want you to do, if you have your Bibles, take you back to Genesis chapter 3. I want to read the end of Genesis chapter 2, just because, again, it is the bridge between the first two chapters of the Bible are the only portions of the Bible in this section that have to do with a sinless world. The last two books of Revelation are the only books that describe a world to come that is without sin. So pre, here's the world. Post, there is the world. Every other portion of the Bible realizes the reality of sin. And here is the transition. It is so wonderful and yet tragic. The man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. Now, the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. And you know the story well enough that we'll not go verse by verse by verse. But as you come into the serpent's seduction of Eve, he says to her, "You will surely not die," the serpent said to the woman, "for God knows when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God. You will be as the gods. You will be like God, knowing good and evil." Or another better translation, "You will know pleasure and pain." So what indeed is being described here is this first phrase, and that is the nature of all sin is comparison. The nature of all sin is a looking at one's status, one's place, one's life, one's body, one's face, one's condition, and simply saying, if only, if I could, I then that point of saying, to whom do you compare yourself? The assumption is, if I could be God, then life would be better. Really? Why is it that you'd like to be like God? Most people say this, I would have all the power I wish and I would have no pain. Well, God is infinite. God is majestic and in control. Do I believe in sovereignty? Utterly. Here's the next sentence. And he has bound himself to humanity. So powerful? Utterly. Powerful, in one sense, conditioned, because in the Trinity today is humanity. What do you think Jesus is doing right now? He's at the right hand of the Father. And who is Jesus? He is fully God and fully man. Somehow the Godhead has aligned itself with humanity sufficiently that in the Trinity is humanity. How do I understand that? I don't. Would I ponder more than I have? Not at all. It is beyond my ken and comprehension. But I can say this. The nature of God is he didn't have to create. He was not bound to create. But in his creation, he has bound himself covenantally to us. Our future is his future. That is how much he loves us. So in that sense, you want to be as God, all-powerful? No, he has limited himself. The infinite has become finite. And you think you want to be like God because you'd be out of pain. Again, I wish we had much more time to answer that. But the bottom line is this: no one in this room escapes daily dissociation. I eat often to avoid pain. Don't know about you. Many people drink. Many people watch TV. Many people escape suffering in one form or another. God sees every single harm his creation has perpetrated today. Today. And he has not turned his face from the Nigerian woman and, frankly, mass of women who have been raped today. And he does not turn himself from the face of the Karen man or woman, the southeast portion of Burma, not Myanmar, who is being hunted down like animals. The longest running civil war in the world and one of the longest lasting Holocausts in the world. And most people don't even know the name of the Karen people, let alone the other six hill tribes in the crescent-shaped realm of Thailand, Burma, India, China, Laos, and Vietnam. How's your day? I hope it's been an intriguing, I hope to some degree entertaining day. I hope there's been good thought, good reflection. God has suffered every wound, every harm, every murder, every rape, every abuse, every torture, all human cruelty. God never dissociates. God never turns from the day to watch the news so that he doesn't have to see and feel his own suffering. So you want to be as God? May you be. May you be as limited and self-serving, and may you suffer as God so has chosen. So when we wish to be as gods, may you wonder what it is that you ask for. Now notice what happens when the serpent has successfully seduced. Two categories, and because of time, I'll underscore it this way. You know enough about this passage to know that what happens when God walks in the still of the night, and that is the image in the ancient Near East of when you party. Why does God show up in the cool of the night? Well, because the heat of the day was when you were either working and or when you were siesting. And so what happens is you come to eat and drink, to talk. So why is God showing up in the cool of the night? He's coming to talk, to hang out with Adam and Eve. That's what he did as he engaged his creation. He wants to play with you. He wants to party. He wants to talk. He's so curious what you've read, so curious what you're thinking, what you've written, what poetry, what movies, what TV shows intrigue you. God wants to talk. So he's come, but the sound of his footsteps only expose that you know there has been in your own heart death, rebellion. And so what does Adam do? He hides. You must hear this phrase. Every marriage involves two people hiding. And so to ask as simple a question, how do you hide? In the middle of some of the moments in our own family when there was war with my children. At one point when my daughter was arrested when she was 16 years of age for having alcohol in her trunk, and we had to literally get her out of jail. For weeks on end, I went to escape to the one world that seems justifiable within my realm. What do I do? I love being here with you, but my major work is I'm a teacher. I teach at the Seattle School. And if you're thinking in any form of further graduate work, training and counseling, pastoring, or art, or reflections on life, truly, at least in this community, one of our ever so glorious graduates, you know only too well, a gentleman by the name of Blaine Hogan. You could talk to Blaine or Margaret about our school, but if you're thinking about graduate work, that's what I do. I'm a teacher. I'm an academic. And so as an academic, you know what I get to do? You know what people do? Pay me. They pay me to read. What a ripoff. So at one of those points when life was crumbling, I hide. How do I hide? I have a library. I have a very nice library. And it's a place, it's a space that pretty much everyone's off limit to. And there were times when things were not going well with my children, and my wife was pleading with me to engage. One time she literally stood in the way of my library and she said, "I beg of you, don't turn away from us and hide in your books." So where do you hide as a man? Where do you hide as a woman in the way you clean the house and the way you make phone calls, the way you continue on doing the work for your corporation? How do you hide from dealing with the conflict? That's Adam and Eve. Now, what happens when Adam is exposed is he doesn't just flee in shame. If you'll turn the page, it says he begins and she begins to fight with contempt. So we don't just hide. A second key word is this: we blame. And there's no one I blame more often than anyone in the world, than my wife. Here's a classic line. Are you already predicting it? Where are my keys? Her response? I don't know. Really, come on. Now, between the two of us, as you could probably just look, I'm the messy one. I'm the one who doesn't know where things are. My wife loves order. She loves a kind of structure. And in our pantry, kids love this. She has every container in the pantry marked. Spices, A to C, D to whatever. And you look at it, it's just like ridiculous. Like, who needs to have all this marked? Well, apparently everyone in her family. Goes, where's the salt? Where's the vinegar? Where's the chocolate? And all she has to do is go, read the signs. Well, I've lost my keys. Where are my keys? I mean, it is very possible my wife, who dislikes disorder, could have put the keys, but if she did move the keys, I promise, 9 out of 10 times she would have put them where we had agreed they should go. But that doesn't matter because I'm not looking actually for the keys. I'm looking for the keys, but I'm looking to escape shame. And then one of the prime ways to escape shame is to find somebody else to bear it for you. And in that case, that's why I married my wife. She's meant to be there to bear my shame. And so I'll say, where are my keys? I think you moved them. And one of the last times this happened, she looked at me and she said, have you looked in the freezer? I said, of course I've not looked in the freezer. Are you crazy? Why would I look in the freezer? She said, I don't know, other than you had opened the freezer about 4 or 5 minutes ago, so could they be there? It's like, no. She said, would you look? Whatever. I opened the door, and it's so hard when you see your keys looking back. Because really, what I want to do is this. No, they're not there. But sort of that, open it up, look at it, see it, grab them, and go, okay, they were there. Did you put them there to make a point? And she's going, no, of course not. Blaming relieves a sense of responsibility. It empties us of feeling accused, and it allows us to, in many ways, feel for a moment or two free from shame. The problem is, of course, it only reverberates back. Blame to blame, blame to more blame, more to stonewalling, more accusations, maybe an eventual apology. But the bottom line is we're looking at how the relationship functions. But what is the real issue? And I want to begin to move toward this whole issue of what does it mean for us to suffer to become one? If these are the core problems, we attack, we hide, we blame, we accuse, and we are so far from what we have spoken of loyalty, of honor and openness, and growing in intimacy. Now, what's involved in the process of change? Page 16, I must enter your suffering. Do I know what your suffering is as a woman? No, I do not. I'm a man. Do you understand my suffering as a man if you're a woman? No. Not in the same way. And yet, we are more alike than we are different. And we have more capacity to join than we have to be differentiated. So for us to begin to name what's the nature of the war allows us to go from some description of the war of Genesis 3 to the passage I most want us to look at, starting in verse 16. Speaking of what will be the consequences, he said to the woman, "I will make your pains in childbearing very severe. With pain you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you." To Adam, he said, "Because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return." If we do not understand that passage, I don't think we can grow together to have the marriage that we would desire. What is required to understand? What is the curse or so-called consequence for women? What is it for men? Let me summarize it, and then we'll go through a little more detail. The issue for every woman is this core question: am I too much? Am I too much for my brothers? Too much for my father? Too much for my husband? Am I too much? Am I too bright? Am I too emotional? Am I too gifted? Am I too troubled? Am I too much? And therefore, one of the operating principles of most women, especially in most Christian worlds, and I don't want to overgeneralize, but I also do not want to miss tendencies in the reality of our culture. A really bright, gifted, funny, witty, strong, wise, competent woman scares many men to death. And so many women know, if I want relationship with a man, I must, as if, is this a rheostat? Do rheostats turn lights down? Okay. It's almost as if you know your glory is so bright that if you let it be as bright as it is, there are many men in the world who will not want to have a relationship with you. And so the requirement is, take that 8 or 9 and turn it down to a 2 or 3. And you know that even if that's not true more endemically, you know that's true in certain fights with your spouse, you know that's true in certain conflicts with your father, you know you just can't be fully yourself, because to do so, it unnerves the male world around you. The question for a woman is, am I too much? As you can well expect, the issue I'm going to argue for a man is this: am I enough? Do I have enough? Do I have enough guts? Do I have enough brains? Do I have enough perseverance? Am I enough for my world, for my children, for my spouse, for my family, for my church, for my world, for my country? Am I enough? And what I'm arguing is that evil has been at work from the itty-bitty days of your life as a woman to say, you are too much, you are too much, you are too much. Shut up. Shut up. Keep quiet. Be polite. Be nice. Get along. Keep your legs together. Smile. This is what a woman does. This is how a woman acts. You want to be loved? Get in line and shut up. And what I'm arguing is that since you were a little boy, evil's been coming along to say, you're not smart enough. You're not big enough. You're not fast enough. In the locker room in 7th and 8th grade, your penis is not big enough. You're not picked for the baseball team. You're not the brightest bulb in the pack. Better just learn to live. You're all right. You're average. You're decent. You'll do okay. Yeah, you're sort of lower middle management, but there's a job for you. Just don't rock the boat. Don't ask too much. Don't dream too big. Just do your job. Shut up. Isn't that interesting? That's where evil ends for all of us. Don't know your story. Don't bring your voice to this world. Don't create. Don't grow. Just stabilize. Shut up. So as we look at these passages, I don't want you to forget the point. I am in a relationship with a woman who thinks she's too much. And I'm a man who thinks he's not enough. And a lot of our conflicts really aren't about money, time, children, in-laws, sex, etc. What we're really pushing back against is this more core issue that, frankly, it's a lot harder to face that issue than to actually then step away from the petty arguments to get to the real issue of, look, my love, I feel chronically like I was not a good enough president. I don't teach well enough. I don't put enough time into this. I could lose more weight. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not as disciplined. You can continue that litany almost until the day you die. Now, let's look at the passage. What is the issue for a woman? There are two issues for a woman. First, she will have pain in childbirth. Though it may sound cruel, and there is an element to which I feel it as cruel. As I've recently gone through the third miscarriage of a dear friend of mine. I've not even spoken to her since the third one has occurred. But as I sat with her and her husband after the second, and she's hurt, she's grieving, she's angry, she's confused, and to simply be with her. Do you hear that comes fundamentally because of the consequence that comes by God's call of suffering? How do I make sense of that? I don't. I don't know what to say with it. As I sit with a young couple that lost their baby one day before the child was to be born, in birth, the cord had been wrapped around the child's neck and literally was strangulated to death. And she gave birth to a stillborn child. As I sit with them a few weeks after, and for 5-6 hours, hear them, weep with them, hear what they have written. What am I going to say? Oh, by the way, I just need to mention to you that this is all predictable. A woman will suffer in childbearing. This is not minor. You don't pass this material with, oh yes, menses, monthly curse. Do you understand? A woman was made to give birth. And in one of the most unique parts of her, the fact she has a womb, a place where life grows. Do you understand that there is no human being in the world that can comprehend the fact that a life grows within a life? As a man, I get it. But I have no experience comparable. Everything I create is external. For a woman, her womb becomes the safe respite for a child to grow. And as this wonderful, wonderful woman goes, my womb became the grave. It became the tomb for my son. All that I can do with her is not say, well, I'm sure you will have more children. Somehow God will redeem. Do I believe that? Mostly. But all I can do is join her in what it is that the curse brings, and that is grief with her. So a woman's womb will be a place of agony. And in that agony, there will be death and life. And even when life comes, there will be disappointment in what life brings. It will never be as you would fully wish or desire. And how do we see that work out in the second portion? And that is, your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. Those are difficult words. The word desire in that passage is only used in its Hebrew equivalent one other time in the whole Old Testament. It's in Genesis chapter 4. And it's when God is speaking to Cain, and he says to Cain, do you not know that sin is at the door? Literally, he's using the metaphor that sin is like a crouching animal, hidden in the foliage, waiting to jump on you and devour you. And God says this, "Do you not know sin is crouching at the door, waiting for you, and its desire is for you?" And what the word desire seems to imply is this, the notion of ravenous desperation. So if we understand what this word says with regard to what a woman's going to suffer in her marriage and in life, whether she's married or not, she's going to suffer a kind of ravenous hunger, a kind of desperation that literally wants to devour in order to fill that emptiness. If we look at eating disorders, it is not to say that men do not suffer with eating disorders, but almost at a rate of 15 to 1, women suffer far more eating disorders, far more codependency, and there's far more presence of alcoholism at stage 1, stage 2 levels for many women than what's often acknowledged. What I'm asking you to be aware of is that women feel empty, and in that loneliness and emptiness, they will often do almost anything to assuage, to take away that particular loneliness. How? Obvious ways, getting busy. And a lot of busyness in a home, a lot of busyness and busyness at home and at work, a lot of busyness with children becomes a way of having to escape their own heart, their relationships, and indeed their desire. I think a second way that many women escape is through playing with matters that do not matter. Again, I'm not trying to critique, I'm simply saying that when you spend hours cleaning your home to have it become almost perfect before guests come. That's almost an entirely profound way to ruin hospitality. When you create burden for yourself to have the right meal and the right cutlery and the right context, so much of your life is spent trying to do well. So in that sense, the consumption in presentation, working to make sure people are pleased, becomes a way of having to escape one's own loneliness. And as I said, there are many women who have relationships with other women, and those relationships, call them soul friends or not, where you often share more with other women friends than you would your own spouse, where indeed you share so much that in many ways you don't need to share with your spouse because the deepest intimate relationship you have is not with your spouse, but with a number of friends. Again, am I critiquing friendships? Of course not. Am I saying you shouldn't have one or two friends you deeply, deeply confide in? Of course not. But when you know you confide in your friends in a way that you will not deal and with the same issues with your own husband, what I'd say is you're escaping. So there are many ways that a wife, a woman, can escape loneliness, busyness. But the number one way, children. Children. I'm not going to step too far into this. I'm grateful my children are of the age that they are. I'm also grateful that our children continue to forgive us. It is not they forgave us. It is they continue to forgive us. But I didn't grow up in the era, and my children didn't grow up in the era, where we spent virtually all our lives in a car. Our children could choose one sport, not three, not four, not five. And when they chose one sport, they could never become so good at it that it became consuming for their future. Why? I've got great athletes, but I doubted any of them are going to play professional tennis or any other sport. Indeed, if you have a child like that, perhaps you have a very different category. But I think in our day and age, we have consumed the life of parents and children with activities, with extracurricular activities, music, drama, after-school activities, to a point in which the average American meal, 1920, was 90 minutes. As of about 4 years ago, the average American meal is 12 minutes. You cannot do discipleship. You cannot grow conversation. You cannot learn about life together. Now, if your children are rushing to a meal, sitting down, piling it down, running off to the next homework or other activity. Now, to be a believer in our culture, you must be countercultural, which basically means that in so many ways, a wife has to say, my children will leave, my spouse will stay. and I'm going to stay with my spouse. I remember one of those moments where my two daughters were in a brawl with one another. It was ugly. And at one point, they drew me into the conflict, asking which one of them was correct given their own differing opinions. And remember at that point, looking at them and going, and they were literally, one had one arm and the other had the other, and we were walking, and I felt like a piece of chicken being pulled apart. And I remember looking at them and saying, you know, actually, I don't have a whole lot of wisdom about either of you. I think you're both wrong. You probably are both right. But fundamentally, you're all going to leave my home, and I'm going to stay with my wife, and that's who I'm going to be with. And both daughters looked at me and just said, you are a coward. And I said, no, I'm a wise man who loves his wife. You deal with a conflict between the two of you. And if one of you comes back and the other doesn't, well, to the survivor, all the spoil. So will you acknowledge with your own children that they're not your life and they're not meant to be your life? And they may take much of your time, but not the deepest part of your heart and not the core commitments of your soul. So what's the nature for a woman to have to wrestle with? Are you willing, without dissociation, without alcohol, without music, without busyness, without mere friends, are you willing to wrestle with how much you feel and how much what you feel feels unable for the men in your world to really understand and to engage? And that doesn't mean blurting it all out, yelling and being angry that you're not understood. It's a matter of being willing to say, are you willing to open your heart to name what it's like to be a woman and to know your womb is under war and your desire for your husband is desperate? And the response of a husband, it says he will rule. Is that a positive word? Good word. Well, she's a little desperate, a little out of control, but wonderful. She has a godly husband who will rule over her. No, that's not what the word implies. What it implies is this: a man uses shame and withdrawal to escape feeling overwhelmed by a woman that he doesn't know what to do with. So it means that every male-female relationship, married or not, every male-female relationship will have at least some of the tensions of, can I truly be honest with you? Can I really tell you what I'm thinking? Am I able to process what's happening between us? May we grow together through words. Yes, it's true for marriage. It's true for all male-female relationships. And for many women, the response, and please hear the words, the word is, it is wrong for you to silence your voice. It is wrong for you to deny your loneliness. It is wrong for you to cover it over and hide it from him, let alone from your own heart. So our task as a man, my task as a man is to enter my wife's loneliness and to know that many times when she's withdrawing, when she's critical, when she's curt, when she demands a decision be made, those aren't the issues. There's a far deeper issue. My wife is lonely. My wife is afraid there's more in her than I have the ability to handle. Therefore, what does it call me to have to do? To be empathetic isn't strong enough. I must incarnate myself with her. I must become enfleshed. And enfleshed means this: I must enter into her suffering. Even though it is not my suffering, not in the same way, I need to be willing to enter into what the world feels like for her to be afraid, to be overwhelmed, to indeed feel like she is too much. What is the world for a man? Next page. If you recall from the passage, we'll not return to it. What is the war for a man? The war for a man is twofold. Every day he goes into a realm where there are thorns and thistles. And every single day, the world is not supple. The world is not available. It does not make itself easily available for his plucking fruit from the lower branches. The phrase low-hanging fruit, I'm sorry, it's an oxymoron. There's no such thing as low-hanging fruit in our world. There's withered fruit. There's high tree fruit. There's fruit that's very hard to get to without great danger. So what's the reality for a man? The reality for a man is this: everything you do will be thwarted. Everything. Write a play, it'll be thwarted. build your medical field license. It'll be forwarded. Go to school, it'll be forwarded. Have children, they'll thwart you. Nothing will be easy. And to put it in, again, very, very clear language, you will sweat every day. And the fruit you will pluck has thorns, and you will bleed. Can you not hear the word? It's the word futility. How do I feel as a man? It's all futile. Why bother? Nothing works. Nothing works. Certainly nothing works for long. Second part of the curse is this. Everything that you build will one day turn to dust. So even where you are successful, you will have to face that it will be handed over to a fool. The institution you built will be under control of people who do not hold your views, your understanding, your passion. Rare, rare, rare when the first generation hands off to a second generation. First, second generation hands off to a third or fourth generation. Very, 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 very unlikely that the passions that brought you to do what you do will be carried on by people second, third, fourth generation beyond it. Nothing lasts. And you hear again the litany, the chorus that comes back again and again. Why bother? Why try? Why fail? Why strive? It's not going to work, not going to last. So do you hear the core issue, as I said, for a man to be this? I'm not enough. So why try? What do men do to escape that? Their passion becomes a form of watching others suffer. Shall I try that again? Are you with me? I know it's late in the day. You've heard a lot of words. You know, at this point, we're rounding pretty much the last corner. Promise you we'll end at 5 o'clock. Suck it up. Let's run hard. What did I just say? Men find ways vicariously to watch others suffer. That's how they deal with their own curse. What did I just describe? Sports. And thank God, football doesn't last all year, but one level, you could probably watch games all year. I think collegiate sports are mostly nonsense. Collegiate sports tragically run most universities. It's pathetic. It's wrong. Pro sports, it is so fundamentally violating that a human being who can hit a ball, I don't care how hard it is to hit a ball, catch a ball, get hit by another person when they catch the ball, makes a dollar more than a teacher. I resent that. I don't think there's anything... I don't think there's anything more honorable than being a fourth grade teacher. And so if you happen to be a fourth grade teacher, I look at you and go, I remember my fourth grade teacher, and she was wicked. And she made me feel stupid. She shamed me often in class. And I questioned how bright I was probably until I was 24, 25 years of age, because fourth grade was horrendous. But what I'm asking you to be aware of is whether it's possible. And again, I'm not looking at you if you're wearing sports insignia. I'm all for it. I'm all for sports. And sports are in the Bible. And and blah 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 blah. But let's just put it this bluntly: if you, as a man, get so sad when your team loses that it is not comparable to when your wife helps you name your failure of love. If you get sadder over your team's loss than you do over the sin you have perpetrated against your wife, all I can say is, oh my gosh, grow up. truly grow up. Sports are a ridiculous portion of our cultural's enterprise of consumerism and flight from the kingdom of God. Is there still a place for sport? Of course, of course, of course. If you play what you watch, one to one, half to one, a quarter to one. Go ahead and throw the football. You like football? Play it. Don't watch it. Why? Because for 3 or 4 hours you sit truly as a lump, groaning, moaning, celebrating, and your wife is watching you going, even sex doesn't move you like this. That's a problem on many levels. So where we're moving with this, it really comes back to, do you understand most men are living passive lives? You love numbers, so you memorize the box scores of baseball players, and you can make comparisons between the White Sox, Black Sox, Red Sox from one year to another, 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 another. But you cannot remember what the ambiance was like the night you asked your wife to marry you. You cannot remember the meal that you had. But you can remember the run that was hit, or the hit that was run, or somehow the ball that went, or the person that was hit, or something that happened. You can know that moment like it's life for you. And yet you will not remember the moments that are so much more precious, like when your son was born and you got to hold him in your arms. Which is a more important moment to you? And you go, well, of course, my son's birth. Yeah, well, how often do you talk about it compared to the other things you talk about? So all I'm asking is, darn, give up vicarious living. And so if I were to ask you, what is it that you bring to the kingdom of God that will be lost if you do not bring your life to bear in it? What do you hate? What do you hate? Just the thought of it turns your blood. And for me, it's human trafficking. I've been in Burma. Been in Thailand, been in Laos, been in Cambodia. And I've looked at 6-year-olds and 8-year-olds who have been having sex with Western men since they were 3 and 4 years of age. If that does not turn your heart to fury, then what I would ask is, what will? My passion does not need to be yours. If you have the same hatred about AIDS, you have the same hatred about racism, you have the same hatred of how people who are so-called mentally handicapped are treated in our world. I don't care what passion you have, but I would ask you this, as a man, what do you want to say no to with your life? What are you willing to take a bullet for? And if the answer is your golf score, to somehow drive it down a few more handicap points, I really want to look you in the eye and say, are you alive? Have you read about the Holocaust? Which one? Jewish? Cambodian? Armenians? Or the Karen? There are Holocausts happening in your lifetime today. And does it move you? And if it does, so what? What are you doing? So as a man, what do you do to say no to the kingdom of darkness? Your wife wants a warrior who will fight against evil beginning in your own heart. Your husband wants a warrior who has a passion for relationship and the integrity of beauty and is willing to take risks to fight to bring it about in her own life and in her family, let alone her church and her community and her world. I will vote for no man or woman who treats another candidate with contempt. I am sick of the Democratic Party. I am sick of the Republican Party. I'm sick of being a Christian in a world in which the accusations from Democrats to Republicans and Republicans to Democrats are vile and untrue. And even if it has a portion of truth, there is something that we have lost in our world called charitability, a capacity to believe and to want good. For any human being to say that our president wants to ruin purposely our country, I find hideous and abominable and should not be allowed, should not be sort of ignored as, oh, that's your political opinion. To say that you think our president is an evil man, I think is foolish. So we create a context where we honor one another, where we dispute one another with care and respect and honor. What do you want to say no to? If you're a Republican, you stand in the Republican Party and say, I will not have my party speaking against the president in that language. Take him on. Tell him where he's wrong. Say what should be done, but it should be with honor. You do not hang a murderer with dishonor. That's the nature of the glory of human dignity. You better be ready to say no to nonsense, no to what should never be part of the way we operate with one another. You differ with me on my view of this? Fine, let's talk, let's argue. But afterwards, let's go play. That's how we should be. So what do you want to say no to? What do you want to say yes to? And yes is, what will you build in this world that brings a taste of life for others? And whatever that is, be it a flower garden, a new insurance agency, a new play, a new child, all I can say to that is, grow glory wherever you land, wherever you are, grow glory. And if you will do that, what I think you'll begin to find is that we don't need to watch other people suffer. Why? Because we're suffering enough. You don't need to watch a reality TV show. Why? You don't need to watch other people strive against obstacles to see if they can lose weight or gain. You'll actually be doing it yourself. So stop the nonsense of letting your own life be guided by those who want to sell you products. That's the only reason they have you watching the show. It's not because they really want to entertain you. They want you to buy the products. So you really to bind your own heart to a consumer? Fundamentally adversarial culture? Please, your one stunningly beautiful, glorious life is worth more than that. So as a man, you need to begin to engage where you have let others live your life. And secondly, men, turn easily. Not to say women do not. That is a huge misnomer. There are many women in this room who struggle with pornography. And most of that came because of your own past sexual abuse. But many men in this room struggle with pornography. And why pornography? Many women struggle with their men who struggle with pornography, feeling at one level like, why wouldn't you want me? Why would you rather turn to pixels on a screen or a celluloid picture that is not even true to who the woman is on a page? Why? I'm alive for you as a woman. Why would you choose her? And here's the simple answer. Because you're available. And because you want. And because you would make love. And here's the reality. When men go, studies have been done. Men go to massage parlors to pay for sex. What do they pay for? They can have any kind of sex that they would wish to pay for. What do they pay for? Oral sex. Why oral sex? Pretty simple. See, if a man has intercourse with a woman, he could become impotent. Premature ejaculation. Already said, many men suffer with premature ejaculation. A man may not be sexually competent enough to be able to please the woman. He's even paid. So why does he pay for all sex? All he has to do is be there, be aroused, and pleasure will come. Hear the point. A man chooses pornography because he wants to escape the hard face-to-face engagement with a woman. At least the woman on the page with the come-hither look is fundamentally saying, I'm easy. I will not reject you. There will be no risk. There's no danger. That's why I take you back to those two questions. As a man, you will suffer with vicarious pleasures and or the misuse of those kinds of images unless you can answer those two questions. What are you willing to die for? And what are you willing to give your blood, your life, your sweat to build on this earth, irrespective of whether it comes to be or not? Nonetheless, your life is willing to move in the direction to say, as long as I am on this earth, there will be people who hear about the reality of sexual harm. That's my calling. That's my yes. That's my no. What's yours? Now, the two questions. Am I too much? Am I not enough? You can see where the intersection of those two worlds lead. Next page. It leads to sorrow. And this is where I begin, with just 23 minutes left, to offer at least just a handful of hope for you, a handful of invitation of what direction I would hope you would begin to move. I don't believe there's anything more deeply cementing for a relationship to grow than the capacity to begin to weep together. If you cannot weep for your own wife's suffering, there will not be enough lubrication for your hearts and bodies to indeed be able to merge into the kind of union that God intends. And so the question for a man is simply this: what has kept you from weeping for your wife? Weeping for how she suffered with her mother and father, how she suffered in the abuse, how she suffered against and with her own promiscuity. Have you suffered your wife's story? Equally, what does it mean for a wife to enter the world of her husband suffering with futility? A woman should never say to a man, "But you're successful. You've done so much. I think you're all that I would ever want." Affirmations like that pass like cotton candy. Sweet taste, feels good, doesn't last. Why? Because you're not getting to the root of where I feel and where I've lived for so many years of my life, feeling that sense of profound inadequacy. Would you step into my stories? Would you hear about the shame that I felt? I didn't do well in school. I graduated with a 1.8 average from my high school. It's illegal. You cannot graduate somebody unless they have a 2-point average in my school. My teachers hated me so deeply. They didn't care what they had to do to get me out. I graduated from college. I improved. 2.1 average. It took almost most of my life to realize I'm a far brighter man than apparently the academic world allowed me the access to be able to show. So when I say to my wife, I feel so stupid. And my wife looks at me and she goes, "Look at the books you've written on the shelf." Part of me goes, anybody who's willing to bear boredom and endure the monotony of word by word, anybody can write a book. It doesn't help. What I need for my wife to do is to say, "Who are you? How did you come to be so doubtful of your own intelligence, your brightness, your giftedness? Would you tell me your story? And I have heard your story before. Would you tell me your story again?" Here's the simplest way of putting it. A marriage will grow to the degree you sorrow together and sorrow one another's life and sorrow the harm you have brought your spouse and sorrow the harm your spouse has brought you. Are we able to grieve together, to enter death together, to be able to say, "You knew death before and you have known death through our relationship"? Because until you can grieve together, you will not have the ability and the freedom to laugh. And what I'm reflecting is a very simple passage in Romans chapter 12, verse 9 and following. Grieve with those who grieve. Weep with those who weep. Laugh with those who laugh. And a marriage is meant to be the context where my wife's suffering, she knows that there will be no one who joins her more in her suffering than her husband. And if she's not confident of that, then she will hold her sorrow to her own heart and be cautious about how much comes. There's so little I can do with her suffering. Occasionally there's wisdom. Occasionally there's a direction I can offer. But for the majority of my life, all I can do is to say, I am not just sorry, I am sad. And I want to become even sorrowful more with you for what it is that you have endured. Next page. Where does sorrow take you? To the category of forgiveness. And simply said, what does it mean to forgive? I think there are two core parts to forgiveness, whether we're talking about an affair or we're talking about a sharp word spoken at lunch today. Yes, the enormity of one is far different than what could be viewed as the passing harm of the other. Do not want to in any way imply that one of you who has suffered the sin of another's adulterous involvement should be able just to forgive. But I want you to hear what forgiveness is. It is an invitation to the other to join the party of God. It's a canceling of the debt owed. Yes, of course. And is that what you normally hear? Yes. And does it mean, indeed? Yes. Cancel the debt. And how do we cancel any debt? Not easily, not quickly, and hardly ever completely. But to cancel the debt only comes because we have understood derivatively that our debt has been canceled. I cannot forgive an adulterer unless I own my own adultery. I cannot forgive a murderer unless I own and name my own murderous heart. And so in that sense, all forgiveness begins with the odd beginning point of asking, he who is forgiven little loves little. He who is forgiven much has the potential to be able to love much. So to forgive your spouse is the beginning point to be able to say to the other, I know my heart. I know yours, but I know mine better. And my heart bears the log. And this feels absolutely specious in most occasions because it doesn't feel true in the context of a conflict. But to begin with the reality that it is true, I have the log, you have the speck. All our conflicts, I know the log, I can see your speck. And if that one principle becomes part of the way you conduct a conflict, to begin to say, I don't know what you're doing, but I simply know that whatever you're doing feels wrong. And I need to own, I bear the log more than you have the speck. Begins to shift the ground for where indeed our relationship is moving. But is that enough to build the kind of marriage that I would want for you and for myself? No, not enough. What does it mean to forgive? You must have a taste of how good it is to be at God's party. You must have a sense that the pleasure of partying with God is better than anything you could possibly experience in, on, and with this earth and beyond. And what passage am I referring to? Of course, Luke chapter 15 and the story, so-called, of the prodigal. And really, it's the story of the older brother. And what we see in that story, to cut to the chase, is three things. When the son returns, the father saw him from afar. Why is the party such a good thing? Because the father is looking for me each and every day to come home. Every day. Every day, he's looking afar to see if this day is the day that I will trust him with my heart. And the moment he sees me, second, what he does is he runs to me. And where that image becomes so utterly profound is that in the ancient Near East, a man would not run without lifting his gown. And a man would never lift his gown in public unless he was in one context. The only place that a man can take the gown that he is wearing and tie it to the side. You know this language from the phrase girding up your loins. Only one time he can do that without shame, and that's when he goes into battle. And what is it the father does? He waits and waits and looks from afar to see if today you're going to come home. And when he sees your visage on the distance, what does he do? He gets up and runs to you, lifting his gown skirt to the side, showing his legs in public. If you can understand from the ancient Near East, what that's saying is this: God is willing to shame himself for you. He adores you so deeply, he's willing to bear all the shame that you have accrued up to this point. And then when he comes, he wraps his arms around you and weeps. As simple a question as it is, have you ever felt another human being weep in your arms? What is it like to hold a human being when they are so undone that they cannot hold the conventions of propriety in any culture, and they come unglued and they weep in your arms? If you don't have a memory of that, then indeed the next sentence will not matter much. When have you held God and felt his body weep in your arms? If you know the story, what happens is that the one who speaks is the one who breaks physical contact. And the prodigal is the one who speaks next. And he says to the father, I have sinned against you, and goes through a litany of confession. And what I want you to note is the father hears the confession. And the next words that he speaks are these: my son, who is dead, is now alive. Kill the fatted calf. It is time to party. So what does it mean to forgive? I know my heart. I know what I'm capable of. I know what I've done. I know what I could do. I desperately need forgiveness. But more than just I need forgiveness, I don't know how to end our time with something that's so simple. And yet to be understood, it's so sweet. God delights in you. He likes you. He's fond of you. He likes your voice. He likes your photography. He likes your playfulness. He likes the way you make Irish stew. He likes you. And he actually wants to spend time. He wants to go play. He loves fly fishing. He likes long walks. And this Jesus actually talks. Does he talk to you? Does he give you images sometimes of himself that just take your breath away? And this Jesus wants to join your marriage. So what does it mean to forgive? As simple as this. I have never forgiven well, but I long to forgive well. And I know what forgiveness means. It means to be able to look at the one who has harmed me and be able to say, you have meant it for evil. And indeed, God has meant it and used it for good. Therefore, I don't thank you for sinning against me, but I can truly say I thank you to have been used by God virtually like Babylon to drive me back to God. Luther put it this simply: my enemies have always taken me more to the cross of Christ than my friends. Will you bless your enemies? And if your spouse is your enemy, will you be able to look at your spouse before the evening is over and say, our marriage is not doing well, but I will not quit. And I will not continue to use my shame and my contempt to make you pay. One of the things he said, and it's about the only thing I remember, I'm an adulterer, I'm a murderer, I made you pay. I know it's not good, I don't know what to do, but I'm not going to quit. I'm going to try and tell the truth. And I don't know how long it's going to take for me. Do you understand those simple words? The God of the universe is running. The God of the universe is holding you in his arms, and he's weeping that you've named something true. And he's so fond of you that at that point, something in you goes, you don't know how bad I've been. You don't know what I've done. And what's the response of Jesus? Oh, what? You think I'm not omniscient? I know only too well what you have done. I know what you have said. I know where you've gone in your mind. I know what you've done in your private world. And you know what? I am so wild about you. Do you want to go play with me? Will you let the God of the universe play with you? Because he really longs to do so. And if you're willing to let him play, what you'll find is he wants to laugh and dance and drink and eat and listen to music and talk about films and interact about books and read poetry and watch the Bears. The Bears. Yes, he does. Will you? And if so, what begins to happen? Forgiveness opens these last three categories. I want to make it to my 50th anniversary. I really do. I would be just under my actuarial table. And when we come to our 50th, I hope my children speak. They did on our 25th anniversary. Three of them took us out to eat. Lovely restaurant in Seattle. And after the meal that they paid for, which was, wow, fabulous. Any meal would have been good if they had paid for it. Each of my children, and at that time, my very young, probably what, 14-year-old son? No, much younger. 14-year-old son. Opened up envelopes, and they read to my wife and me. And what they were addressing was this question: what if we learned about life by watching the two of you in your marriage? And after the first letter, all five of us, even my son, was weeping and laughing. Got to the second letter, and I was watching the waiter kind of not know quite what to do. You know, when a whole group of five were sort of laughing and then crying and then laughing. You know, at one point, the waiter just, it was one of those lulls where neither tears nor laughter, and the waiter just went, "Do you mind me asking? What's happening?" Because I really want to be sensitive to your table, and there are times you're laughing uproariously, other times you're crying. Is everything okay? And my daughter went, "Yeah, they're celebrating 25 years of suffering." And then she said, "And also beauty and goodness." And he goes, "Wow. That's what I want for our 50th. I want our children and the few friends who were with us at that time to name what they have seen. Isn't that what you want? I want my marriage to matter, not just to be happy, not just to be productive. I want it to permeate the lives of at least a few people." And so what's spiritual healing look like? It's where you know your marriage has opened your heart to delight. I was on a plane last evening. I told the story to another group last evening here in the church. But it was a mother with a young child, probably 6 months of age. And I had a lot of writing to do, and I sat right next to her, and I put my Bose headphones on. I really didn't want to talk. But after about the whole flight, and I had to take it off 20 minutes before we landed, I just sort of had this thought, sort of said, I just sort of heard Jesus say to me, I want you to talk with her. Okay, whatever, good. Okay, what do you want me to say? And what he said was, what do you think of her parenting? Well, the way she had handled her six-month-old almost effortlessly and also with hardly any tears, it made my flight way better. And so I said to him, I said, I think she's a great mom. And what I heard Jesus say was, tell her. I was like, cool. And put my headphones down and looking at her, and I just said, I want you to know, I think you're a really spectacular mom. Her next words were these: oh, I am so sorry. I know having a child is not really probably one of the best things that's happened to you today. And I'm sorry. I hope my son hasn't been too noisy. I've tried to keep him quiet. And I'm looking at her going, do I really want to go the next step? And I did. And what I said to her was this: can you help me understand why you find it so hard to have someone delight in you? I'm telling you, everyone in this room, unless you are really one of the most remarkably mature men and women I've met, I would say, generally speaking, most of us in this room have a very hard time being delighted in. Having somebody be able to name your gifts, your goodness, your heart, and be able to say, wow, I like you. I like being with you. It is good to be with you. You're a really good mom. And when I spoke those words, you're a really good mom, she was almost like this. I can't bear it. So what is a marriage meant to do? It's meant to begin to break down the very core fear of shame all of us have, so that we're able to begin to understand something of the reality of God's delight for us. The fact that he really would wait for you, and that he would really run to you, and that he would really weep in your arms the moment you begin to tell the truth about your own life and your own marriage. And that, indeed, after you finish confessing all your sin, what is God's response to your adultery, to your fantasies, to your perversions, to your absorptions, to your addictions? God's response is, that's his response. Nothing. Nothing. Why? Because there's nothing to be said. It's already been finished. The cross is enough. It's really enough. God's death on the cross is enough to cover all, past, present, and even future. So God's response to your sin, speechless. And his response, go get the fatted calf, because it is time to go play. And so what is marriage? Marriage is a context for me to begin to know God's delight. Secondly, it's an opportunity for me to begin to change as a man, as a person. As I said, I have lived a violent past. I have not been a good man. I've done great harm. And I have a tender, wild, sweet, playful, witty, dangerous woman who actually thinks I'm more than a good man. She thinks I'm handsome. Jesus, bless you for blindness. Or brilliance of eyes to see. Whatever. All I can say is my story, my soul, who I am, my name is Dan Allender. Is it? No, actually, my name was Dan Patrick Price. What? My father adopted me. My actual name is Price, P-R-I-C-E. Is that my name? No, it actually isn't. My father and his grandfather changed their name from P-R-E-I-S-S. I'm a Russian Jew. Who am I? Who am I? My Dan Patrick Price, P-R-E-I-S-S, P-R-I-C-E, or Dan Bruce Allender? I'm confused. I'm near 60, and I'm barely beginning to know who I am. And my wife loves my story. She grieves. She's angry. She wants to take down every abuser that harmed me. She trembles with rage. She weeps. But she's the one who read my story well enough. When we began what used to be called Marcel Graduate School, now the Seattle School, at the point in time I had an offer for one excellent job, and my wife and I were with other friends thinking about starting a graduate school. And we looked at this list of things to go do. Positives to go start a school, very few, a lot of negatives. This other job, a lot of positive, one negative. And my wife was the one who read my story, and she said this, Dan, you have never in your life done anything normal. And if you go get a job at this other school, it would be reasonable, it would be rational, it would make sense. It is the normal thing to do. And I said to her, you're telling me you think that we ought to ruin our lives by being part of the startup of a graduate program? And she said, I'm just telling you what I know to be true about your story. You have never done anything normal yet. Why would you want to begin now? Redemption of our story comes when our spouse is able to say, I bless your yes and I bless your no. And I join your yes and your no, and you join my yes and no. And finally, before we end, obviously, the strands of a beautiful, beautiful song ought to be coming into your mind as we talk about Marvin Gaye and sexual healing. And we'll end it with this simple sentence. What marriage is about is the potential moment that we can come back into Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, with integrity and the possibility of it being true. That the two of us can be naked. That the two of us can be sexual, and that we're able to look at one another, even with our own sins against one another, our own promiscuity, our own harm, that we can look at our own status and be able to say, with all the flaws and all the brokenness and all the scars and all the places in our life that need redemption to this day, you are beautiful to my eyes, my beloved. And when you can say those words to your spouse, you are beautiful to my eyes, my beloved. Whether you are a 70 or 80 year old man, barely able to make your way across the intersection, then I can say what is true about your life. It has been lived well. And may that be true for our marriages. Thank you.